Please turn in your Bibles to 1 Thessalonians chapter 2. And guys, I'm so sorry, Tim. I need to just say ahead of time, there's no way I'm finishing by 12:30. And if I try, then I will just be throwing out just choice material. But that's going to throw the schedule off, right? And then lunch, and then everybody's annoyed at me the rest of the day. Yeah. Okay. We'll do our best. We will do our best. We will do our best. 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, the title of this message is Profile of a Pastor. And I will begin reading in verse 1. For you yourselves know, brothers, that our coming to you was not in vain. But though we had already suffered and been shamefully treated at Philippi, as you know, we had boldness in our God to declare to you the gospel of God in the midst of much conflict. For our appeal does not spring from error or impurity or any attempt to deceive, but just as we have been approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel, so we speak, not to please man, but to please God, who tests our hearts. For we never came with words of flattery, as you know, nor with a pretext for greed, God is witness. Nor did we seek glory from people, whether from you or from others, though we could have made demands as apostles of Christ. But we were gentle among you, like a nursing mother taking care of her own children. So, being affectionately desirous of you, we were ready to share with you not only the gospel of God, but also our own selves, because you had become very dear to us. For you remember, brothers, our labor and toil. We worked night and day that we might not be a burden to any of you while we proclaimed to you the gospel of God. You are witnesses, and God also, how holy and righteous and blameless was our conduct toward you believers. For you know how, like a father with his children, we exhorted each one of you and encouraged you and charged you to walk in a manner worthy of God, who calls you into his own kingdom and glory. Over the past 30 years that I have had the privilege, and it has been quite the privilege, to serve Sovereign Grace, there are two questions that I am commonly asked. The first question would be, how can I plant a church with Sovereign Grace? I'm always humbled when somebody approaches me with this question. Answering this particular question has proven to be difficult, particularly earlier in our history. No doubt leaving many asking the question somewhat confused and disappointed. It's been difficult because we haven't historically excelled in creating a clearly defined and immediately accessible process to attract and to identify and to train and to deploy church planters. I'm very grateful that in recent years, because of the fine work of fine men I have the privilege to serve with, that has all changed. When I am asked to describe Sovereign Grace, my response is normally, we are small, but we are slow. The second most commonly asked question is, how do you identify a potential pastor? How do you identify a potential pastor? How do you identify a potential church planter? What distinctives do you want to characterize a potential pastor or church planter in Sovereign Grace? Now, my answer to this good question isn't complicated or confusing, because the answer to this question has been revealed in Scripture and revealed in a very specific and a compelling way in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2. So what do I look for in a potential pastor, potential church planter, actual pastor? I look for some resemblance to the description Paul provides of himself in this chapter. You simply cannot improve on the content of this chapter in relation to a profile of a pastor. 1 Thessalonians is among the earliest writings, if not the earliest writings, of the church planter, the pastor par excellence to a newly planted church that he was prematurely separated from due to persecution. And this chapter, chapter 2, is a unique glimpse into the heart of Paul. In chapter 2, Paul is uniquely self-descriptive, and he provides us with this most personal glimpse into his heart. So here in this passage, we discover his personal profile, and here we discover the biblical profile for a pastor as well. So let me ask you before we proceed, how familiar are you with 1 Thessalonians 2? How familiar are you with this chapter, the content of this chapter? So I mentioned Mark's book a moment ago. I am very grateful for that book. I am very grateful for different books on pastoral ministry, church planting, on the local church that have been written and that are available today. I could give you my list of books that have marked my life and that have made a significant difference in my life, and I am grateful for those books. But It is all too possible for me to be informed by, conversant with, enthusiastic about writings that are clearly of secondary importance. Not unimportant, but of secondary importance, while I neglect the material that is of primary importance, Holy Scripture. I think we should be more familiar with 1 Thessalonians 2 than we are that any book that has been written today related to pastoral ministry. And by the way, all the good ones draw your attention to Scripture. But if you are not familiar with the content of 1 Thessalonians 2, well, you've got some work to do, and you have got something to look forward to. And here's what I pray. I actually pray this simple sermon creates an appetite in your soul to study this chapter, actually to study the entirety of this letter, because the content of this chapter, when understood and applied, will make a discernible difference in your life for the rest of your life. So, what do we discover? What do we discover as we consider the profile of a pastor that is revealed in this text? Well, here's what should be immediately obvious to all of us. There is little in this text about methodology. Little in this text about methodology, but there is much in this text about theological and pastoral priorities. And theological and pastoral priorities must inform our methodology. So I want to draw your attention to two primary points from this passage that I think give us just a vivid picture of the heart of a pastor and ultimately form the profile of a pastor. First, what is the profile of a pastor? He's a man with a heart for the gospel. He's a man with a heart for the gospel. And in this passage, Paul reveals his passion and priority to the church and for the church, and he reveals something so important, of critical importance, about his self-understanding as a pastor. How did he view himself? How did he view himself when he came to Thessalonica? Well, he tells us how he viewed himself in verse 4. He viewed himself as one who had been approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel. And I want you to feel the weight of those words. To be entrusted with the gospel. Approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel. Lord, may we all freshly feel the weight of those words upon our soul, and may they make a difference in our personal lives and our pastoral ministry as well. Fundamentally, he viewed himself as one entrusted by God with the gospel. Viewed himself as a steward. steward, trusted with the message of the gospel, a message of inestimable value, viewed himself as a steward and trusted with his message, ultimately accountable to God for the faithful proclamation of this message. Hibbert, in his commentary on Thessalonians, writes the following. His, Paul, assignment was a trust committed to him by God. His ministry was not a self-chosen work. Thus, to be divinely entrusted with the precious message of the gospel is, he writes, the highest responsibility. Yes, it is. Feel the weight of these words. It is the highest conceivable responsibility. Listen, pastoral ministry is a difficult task. A difficult task. The details that a pastor must attend to each and every day can feel overwhelming. They don't just feel overwhelming, they are overwhelming. The number of decisions a pastor must make each and every day come at the pastor each and every day, fast and furious. Pastoral ministry is no small challenge. But, pastor, your fundamental assignment, my fundamental assignment, the most important assignment that has already been determined for us is we have been entrusted with the gospel. This isn't simply an important part of pastoral ministry. This is the most important aspect of pastoral ministry. The gospel is to be all-encompassing for the pastor. And notice how all-encompassing, notice the all-encompassing nature of the gospel for Paul. Let's just read again verse 2 and note the repeated references. Note the refrain related to the gospel. Verse 2, but though we had already suffered and been shamefully treated at Philippi, as you know, we had boldness in our God to declare to you the gospel of God in the midst of much conflict. Verse 8. So, being affectionately desirous of you, we were ready to share with you not only the gospel of God, but also our own selves. Verse 9. For you remember, brothers, our labor and toil. We work night and day that we might not be a burden to any of you while we proclaim to you the gospel of God. He viewed himself as one, verse 4, entrusted with the gospel. And this must be the self-understanding of every pastor, every pastor. I don't care what your age is. I don't care what your location is. I just don't care. I don't care whether you're Presbyterian, Baptist, Acts 29, Sovereign Grace. The list goes on. That doesn't matter. You must be, if you are a pastor, beholden to the gospel, defined by the gospel, governed by the gospel, because you have been entrusted with the gospel. I'm aware there is no part of church life that you are not responsible for along with your elders, but you are ultimately and most importantly responsible for the gospel. And so that must dominate our self-understanding. What must dominate our self-understanding is that we have been entrusted with the gospel. You have been given something by God, and you must be careful with it. You must treasure it personally. You must proclaim it passionately. And you must protect this gospel vigilantly, because it's a trust and you're a steward. You are not called to innovate. You are called to steward and protect and proclaim and pass on the gospel to the next generation. The gospel you've been entrusted with, to pass it along. And listen, if you view yourself this way, if this informs your self-understanding and your role as a pastor, it will be evident in every way, personally and pastorally. The gospel that will then inform your teaching and preaching, the gospel will be explicitly present in each sermon appropriate to the text. It will be explicitly present. It will be explicitly present in your counseling. It'll be explicitly present in your leadership. It will be explicitly present throughout the church. You will never address a topic divorced from the gospel. You will never exhort anyone to obedience apart from some reference to the gospel. You will never assume that those in your church have sufficient knowledge of the gospel or have somehow exhausted their need for the gospel. And, possibly most important for us in this context, you will give attention to your own heart so that you are consistently, personally affected by the gospel. Because what we must make sure is that we are not simply referencing the gospel. Our hearts must be freshly and continuously captured by the gospel and affected by the gospel. And we must be increasingly amazed by the grace of God that is revealed in and through the gospel. And this must be discernible to all those we have the privilege to serve with the gospel. And that concern, oh my, that concern forms the concern I have for my soul each and every day. I've got a few fears in my life, a few things that dominate my concern for myself. I am concerned that I ever grow familiar with my conversion. I want to, by the grace of God, live my life as if I was converted only yesterday. And the miracle of conversion, I don't want to grow familiar with that miracle. Here's another fear I have. I don't want to become a professional, polished pastor who has grown in skill but is no longer humbled by the gospel, affected by the gospel, reduced to tears because of the gospel, amazed by the grace that is revealed in and through the gospel. It's just all too easy for me to proclaim it publicly, to defend it theologically, but to not be freshly affected by it personally and to grow familiar with it. Our friend John Piper captures this concern in the following exhortation titled, Never Let the Gospel Get Smaller, where he writes, Seek to see and feel the gospel as bigger as years go by rather than smaller. There's the challenge, gentlemen. Our temptation is to think of the gospel is for beginners, and then we go on to greater things. But the real challenge is to see the gospel as the greatest thing and getting greater all the time. The gospel gets bigger in your heart. The gospel gets bigger when in your heart grace gets bigger, Christ gets bigger, his death gets more wonderful, his resurrection gets more astonishing, the work of the Spirit gets mightier, the power of the gospel gets more pervasive, its global extent gets wider, your own sin gets uglier, the devil gets more evil, the gospel's roots in eternity go deeper, its connections with everything in the Bible and in the world get stronger, and in the magnitude of its celebration in eternity gets louder. And who can't hear John say that as I go through that? So keep this in mind, he writes. Never let the gospel get smaller in your heart. Pray that it won't. Read solid books on it. Sing about it. Tell someone about it who's ignorant and unsure about it. Then he quotes 1 Corinthians 15:4. Now I would remind you, brothers, of the gospel. Whew. So, my friends, is it getting bigger? Just think back over the last 6 months, last year. Bigger? Same? Smaller? A faithful steward of the gospel is most passionate about the gospel. And we must give careful attention to our hearts in this regard. Here's the reason why. Your people are not only studying the content of your sermon, they're studying your heart as well. They're studying the content of your sermon, but they are also studying your heart. They're studying your affections. Your people are students of your affections. People you serve are students of your affections. They are students of your passion. Even if they don't articulate it, you can assume, and you would be wise to assume, they are. And New Testament scholar and author Don Carson effectively brought this point to my attention when I heard him make the following observation. I'm riding along in my car, I'm listening to a CD, and when he made this statement I'm about to read to you, actually, I think I pulled the car over. I was so intent on giving my full attention to the statement. He said the following: "If I have learned anything in 35 or 40 years of teaching." Now, when a world-class New Testament scholar just informs you that they are about to inform you of something they've learned in 35 or 40 years of teaching, you best listen up. It'd be wise to give them your full and undivided attention. And that's what I did. And he went on to say, "If I've learned anything in 35 or 40 years of teaching, it is that students don't learn everything I teach them." Okay? I'm tracking so far. Get that? But then, he said, "What they learn is what I am excited about." What they learn is what I am excited about. The kinds of things I emphasize again and again and again and again. And then he said, "And that had better be the gospel." If the gospel, even when you are orthodox, becomes something which you primarily assume, but what you are excited about is what you are doing in some sort of social reconstruction, you will be teaching the people that you influence that the gospel isn't really all that important. Oh, you won't be saying that. You won't even mean that, but that's what you will be teaching. And then you are only half a generation away from losing the gospel. Make sure that in your own practice and excitement, what you talk about, what you think about, what you pray over, what you exude confidence over, joy over, what you are enthusiastic about is Jesus, the gospel, the cross. Oh, those are wise words, brothers. You will ultimately transfer to your church not simply or solely what you teach, but what you are most excited about when you teach. And they perceive this. They perceive what excites us the most, which is why we must give careful attention to our hearts and guard our hearts. It's why our priorities, listen, we must prioritize our passions. We must prioritize our passions. We should not be numbered among those who appear to be uniformly excited about everything. There should be clear, discernible gradations. Our passions should be prioritized. And the passion that should be most easily, readily discernible is our passion for the gospel. Our affections, our emotions, our passions should be reserved, preserved, cultivated in relation to the gospel like nothing else and in relation to no one else. And that should be discernible to those listening to us. Like, here's my little sample list of what I want the church I have the privilege to serve to notice. I want them first and foremost to notice my passion is first and foremost for the gospel. Secondly, then from there, I want them to notice I have a unique passion for my wife, Carolyn. So that when I reference her, I'm not trying to impress them with this. I just think it's the most appropriate individual for me to be passionate about. And I want it to be discernible to them. First and foremost, I want it to be discernible to her. I want it to be discernible to them. And then the list, you know, rounds out church. Church planting, missions, I got a category for sports. I want there to be, it's way down the list, but it's there. I want there to be priorities for my passions. So let's ask ourselves, in relation to this passage, and the gospel we've been entrusted, the attention we need to give to our hearts, is there a unique excitement about the gospel that is obvious to those you serve and lead? So Sunday, if I went to your church and didn't preach, just there, privilege of listening and learning and observing, and I happened to go to lunch with a member of your church, and I asked the member of your church, "What is your pastor most passionate about?" How would that member of your church answer? Is it obvious what you're most passionate about? This is our highest conceivable responsibility. I'd be remiss if I also didn't bring to your attention, it's also our highest conceivable privilege. Whew. What a privilege. What a privilege. Just pause with me for a moment, gentlemen, and contemplate this entrustment. God has entrusted men like you and me with His gospel. I mean, I'm assuming that not many of us were likely candidates for this entrustment. Other than possibly your mom, I doubt many others, if any others, saw this coming. No, nobody. Listen, not even my mom, beginning with my mom, if she were here, saw this coming for me. There's nobody I interacted with prior to my conversion who looked out into my future and said, I see it. I see you in Johannesburg preaching the gospel to pastors. Had somebody said that to me, I would say, I want some of what you are smoking, okay? You name the price on that. I want that. That is powerful stuff. I've never heard more idiocy in my entire life. Listen, no one saw this coming for me, and I'm saying for most of you, no one saw it coming for you either. And therefore, no one should be more amazed as you are that you have been entrusted by God with the gospel. It is the highest conceivable privilege, and I think Charles Spurgeon captures the essence of this privilege when he said the following. I've always felt in my own mind that it was one of the clearest proofs that I had of God's forgiveness of my many sins when I was trusted to preach the gospel. I should think that if a prodigal came back to his father, the old gentleman would kiss him and receive him and rejoice greatly over him. But the next Saturday, the market day, the old gentleman would say, I cannot send young William to market. That would be putting temptation in his way. Here, John, you have always been with me. Go to market and buy and sell for me, for all that I have is thine. William, you stay at home with me. He might not let him see all that he meant, but he would say to himself, dear boy, he is hardly fit for that great trust. I love him, but still, I hardly dare trust him as much as that. But see what my Lord did with me. When I came home to him as a poor prodigal, he said, here is my gospel. I will entrust you with it. Go and preach it. But what an instance of my Lord's love it is that he thus trusts me. That was one of the things that made Paul hold up his hands in astonishment. He said that he had been put in trust with the gospel, and he could not make it out. He was a blasphemer and a persecutor, yet he was put in trust with the gospel. You don't think that was discernible in his preaching? Whew. It should be discernible in ours as well. Brothers, we should just never grow familiar with standing here. I can tell you by the grace of God, I never have. I always walk into the pulpit, and at some point just prior, how did I get here? What am I doing here? Lord, was this your smartest move? It is the highest conceivable privilege. Nothing defined Paul's self-understanding or informed his pastoral ministry more than his heart for the gospel. However, Paul's preoccupation was not exclusively conceptual. He was not preoccupied with the gospel as merely an abstract message. Paul was a pastor, cared for people, cared about people. He was entrusted with the gospel for people. So the second aspect of this profile of Paul, and what must inform our profile of a pastor is a heart for people. A heart for the gospel and a heart for people. And Paul's heart for people is a compelling distinctive. Oh, compellingly present and revealed in this passage. He has informed his self-understanding. He was entrusted by God with the gospel for people. And we see his heart for people reflected in the way he conducted himself in starting this church. And let's just listen in again as Paul describes his heart for the Thessalonians in verse 7. But we were gentle among you like a nursing mother taking care of her own children. So, being affectionately desirous of you, we were ready to share with you not only the gospel of God, heart for the gospel, but also our own selves, heart for people, because you had become very dear to us. So Paul didn't view the Thessalonians as some audience for his preaching. They were very dear to him, very dear to him. His heart was filled with affection for them. And actually, in this passage, in this distinctive, we might be encountering a Paul you're not familiar with. I mean, we're quite familiar with Paul, the brilliant theologian, the strategic missiologist, the courageous apostle. But we might not be familiar with Paul, the gentle, affectionate pastor. In his book on the life and teaching of Paul, I think Knox Chamblin speaks for many of us as he describes a certain impression of Paul that we might have, this larger-than-life figure. Knox Chamblin writes, I have found Paul to be a daunting presence. I suspect that many of us who chat warmly about the blessings we have received from Paul's writings would find it more than a little unsettling to engage him in personal conversation. What a critic once said of Hugh Walpole, some might wish to say of Paul, oh, you are glad he lived, but you are very grateful you didn't know him. Who of us would not want a Van Gogh original on the wall? Who of us would not be nervous at the prospect of sitting down to a meal with him? Let me ask you, what do you think it would be like to have a personal conversation with Paul? What do you think that would be like? Like if Paul were present and you were having lunch with him, would you be a little unsettled right now? What would you anticipate? What would you imagine it would be like to have a personal conversation with him? Well, it would be like verse 7 and verse 8. That's what it would be like. It would be like those verses. 7, 8, and you can add 11. That's what it would be like to have a conversation with Paul. Verse 8. So, being affectionately desirous of you and communicating it without reluctance in written form. I mean, the man's affection wasn't subtle. It wasn't difficult to discern. It was pronounced. And that affection permeates his life, it permeates his preaching, it permeates his leadership, it permeates his letters. Philippians, he describes it as the affection of Christ Jesus, that his affection was the very affection of Christ. Now please don't misunderstand, it's not simply that Paul had unusual relational strengths, because we must be very careful not to assign this affection to a certain personality profile. No, this is theologically informed affection. This is affection that is informed by the gospel and rooted in grace. This is what happens when someone who has been entrusted with the gospel interacts with people who need the gospel and those who have responded to the gospel. And this affection, well, I'm saying it made all the difference in his preaching, his leadership, his appropriate exercise of authority. It was a discernible distinctive in his life. To encounter Paul was to encounter this caring, affectionate heart. And notice in this passage, he's not just describing his heart for them, his feelings toward them. He's actually describing their experience with him and the nature of their interactions with them. So he's repeatedly saying, for you yourselves know, and as you know, and as you remember, and for you remember, and as you know. And that refrain appears throughout the passage. His heart for them was pronounced. So, could those you have the privilege to serve say this of you? How would they describe you? We need to give attention to this because it is. Listen, this is frightening. It is possible to give the gospel and not give myself. It's possible to give the gospel and not give my affection. Possible to give the gospel and not give my heart, not give my life for those who are temporarily entrusted to my care. It is. It's possible to be a skilled communicator, not a pastor. It's possible to be very culturally discerning in your communication, but personally very aloof. Pastoral ministry involves not only proclaiming the gospel, it involves caring for people and caring about people. And caring about them in a way so that they know it. It's obvious to them. They feel it. They're grateful for it. So did those you serve know you feel this way about them? Or do you view your role as primarily preaching to them? No, I'd be careful there. I never want to say anything that leaves even the slightest impression that preaching is anything but most important. So please don't misunderstand. But it is possible just to view our role as preaching to them. Martin Lloyd-Jones said, to love to preach is one thing, and to love those to whom we preach is quite another. Oh, yes, it is. They are different. And you know what? Your people can tell the difference. They can feel it. When we are preaching to them, they should feel our affection for them. They shouldn't feel as we're preaching there's like this adversarial relationship. They should feel affection when we're preaching and when we're interacting with them. So do you feel that? Or is your interaction with people characterized by just a low-grade irritation with people? You're easily distracted by others interrupting or technology. You know, you're rarely fully present in a conversation. Brothers, you know, in a few days you return home. The people you return home to, they aren't an interruption to your ministry. They're the object of your ministry. And I wish I had more time to expand on this, but if your affection for them has diminished, and at times it will, we will all grow weary. Let me just encourage you that the same gospel you've been entrusted with to preach to them, when you reflect upon it, will create affection in your heart for them. So as you view them as those for whom Christ died, it will create affection in your heart for them. And as you pray for them as those for whom Christ died, it will create a fresh affection for them where affection for them has diminished. But I do need to spend at least a couple minutes on this application. Let's just think for a minute. When you return home, you not only want to give them the gospel, you want to ask yourself this, informed by this passage, how can I give them myself as well? Gospel, myself. Let me just give you a few recommendations how you can give yourself, how you can cultivate this affection. First, and probably most obvious, extending hospitality to members in your church is a way to express affection for them and cultivate affection for them. By the way, listen, if there's somebody you're experiencing a diminished affection for, spend personal time with them. It can be a means of the Spirit creating fresh affection for them. Something happens when you hang with people, when you eat a meal with people. Something discernibly different always seems to happen when you have someone over into your home for an unhurried time of interaction over a meal. Something happens so that the next time you see them, it's different. And they feel it. And they know it. So no wonder it's one of the priorities for a pastor in the qualifications for an elder to extend hospitality. By the way, that individual wouldn't even be considered for or ultimately confirmed if there wasn't a heart for people, as evidenced and confirmed by their heart to extend and express hospitality. So how are you doing on hospitality? Let me just give you some other practical things that have helped me. Just these are small things. Look, you don't have to emulate my practices. I'm not advocating these practices so that you can align yourself with my practices. I'm just trying to provoke you to create practices. I often say to individuals in our pastor's college, I'll give you a few of my practices. You don't have to emulate my practices, but you need to have practices. I try to take at least 10 to 15 minutes prior to the Sunday meeting greeting people as they come in. It's not something I'm imposing on you. I just want you to know why I do it. This is what informs my doing it. There is something that happens in my, if I just come from my study to the meeting, if I just come from my study to our time of singing and then, you know, preach, there's something that happens in my soul as the people coming parade by me. I realize who I'm preaching to. Oh, you know, as you greet the single mother of three small children, as you get down and greet the kids, as you stand back up, you realize, okay, that's who you're talking to today, CJ. You might want to keep that in mind. And then she's followed by somebody who's got cancer. Okay, good to keep him in mind. And then he's followed by somebody who's just prospering in every way. Yep, I got to keep him in mind. And they parade by. They feel my affection. My affection for them is cultivated. It informs my preaching. I would encourage you to seize appropriate times in your meeting and in your preaching to communicate your affection for the church. I try to do this each and every Sunday. If not in the meeting, after the meeting, I want to find my way to as many people as possible who've been serving or just attending and express my gratefulness because I'm just amazed they came back. And you should be too. They're back. They came back. After last week's sermon, they came back. I want to express my gratefulness to them. They came back. And look, they're giving again. This is amazing. And look, they continue to sacrifice and serve. Oh my, it is only appropriate for me to communicate my affection for them and my gratefulness to them and to do it constantly. Praying for people is a way to cultivate your affection for them. Listen, when somebody after a meeting or at any time says, would you pray for me? Don't just tell them you'll pray for them. Pray for them. Find out how they want you to pray for them. Pray for them right then. Don't postpone it. I tell you, most of the time when I postpone it, I forget it. And then I feel guilty 3 days later. Or if I've seen them in between and they ask, they say, thanks for praying for me. Then I've got to got to pray quickly so that before they're done, can give a nod with integrity. There have been times where I've had to just say, you know what? I haven't. I didn't. I'm sorry. I'm an idiot. Small practice. It's something I also noticed about small practices. They have a disproportionate effect on people. So something I've done for years is I just write short notes to people in the church. I'm just observing evidences of grace in their life. I'm observing ways they serve and sacrifice and do so joyfully and do so consistently, do so month after month and year after year. So after Sunday meeting, normally on Sunday afternoon, I'm putting together 3 to 5 notes that I'm just sending out to the church. Just communicating my affection. It's not hard to do. They're very dear to me. And it means more to them than I think it should, but I'm not going to argue with them as they come back and tell me, oh, thank you for that note. That was so meaningful. I call my. That took a minute. I
it has a disproportionate effect on them. Listen, in verse 12 is a phrase I love, and it affects me. Paul said, we exhorted, listen, each one of you. Oh my. It's like Paul wasn't just thinking corporate. Large meetings. Nope. There's this each one of you distinctive in his ministry. And I want that distinctive to be a part of my pastoral ministry. I want there to be an each one quality. Each one quality about my pastoral ministry. I'm sure you do as well. Man, the local church, Spurgeon said it's the dearest place on earth. Yes, it is. And brothers, being entrusted with the gospel is not in the highest conceivable responsibility. It's the highest conceivable privilege. What a joy it is. Another Sunday is coming when everybody will be gathered together. You've been entrusted with the gospel. You should also arrive with a heart to encourage and care for people. Because you're being studied. You're being studied for the content of your preaching, for what excites you when you preach, and for your heart toward those you do address. Not trying to minimize how difficult and daunting pastoral ministry is to carry out. It is, oh my, it is a difficult, it is a daunting, it is a difficult and daunting task. I made a reference to this in Cape Town and was going to assign it as the most difficult task and caught myself, I want to catch myself here as well. I don't think it's the most difficult task. I think the most difficult task is being a mother of small children. Okay, I do. I think you have a category for that. Actually, I think there's a task even more difficult than that. I think the most difficult task is being a pastor's wife with multiple small children. So I want to honor them first. And by the way, there's a number of them in the back, okay? Serving and sacrificing in a way I can't relate to. And when our children were little, I mean, I sought to do all I could to honor Carolyn because her task, I would tell her, this is a common refrain in our home, I would tell her what you're doing is more difficult than what I'm doing and what you're doing is more important than what I'm doing. And I was always reminded of that because at different times during the year I would take the kids so that Carolyn could go away for 24, 36 hours, have some unhurried time to do whatever she wants. And because she at times was so tired, that just could mean just doing nothing, just sitting in another location without having any responsibility for her. And I'm telling you, I wouldn't be 2 hours into my 24, 36-hour time, which it's got an end to it. I know exactly when she's coming back. And yet I'm 2 hours into it, and I am exhausted. I am exhausted. I am crying out for grace. I am wondering how she has the grace to do this. She doesn't have any 24, 36-hour thing. I am tired. I love my children, but this is exhausting. I try to create... Oh, if my girls were here, they would tell you. I would do things like, girls, special bedtime tonight. Early bedtime tonight. Dad, we just finished lunch. special early bedtime tonight, girls. Dad, it's only 5 o'clock. We go to bed at 7. We go to bed at 8. I know, girls, but your dad has such a big day planned tomorrow. We all need to be fully rested. I am exhausted. I can't possibly... So Carolyn comes home. I just want you to know this. I mean, I go back to the elders and I just say, no whining. I don't want to hear anybody here complaining, okay? We have an easy task compared to our wives, okay? We sit in Starbucks sipping our grande drinks and working through our agenda. Oh, how daunting, how difficult. You know, I'll have another. You know, I just... My friend, when you walk through the door, you should not walk through the door if you have multiple small children, as if you are making some heroic entrance home, and that before you is a refuge where you must relax. No. You are lazy in comparison to her. You are. You are. You are. But I do believe third on the list is pastoral ministry. It's difficult. It's difficult. It's daunting. It's challenging. Here's what I'm grateful for as I read this passage. I don't think it's complicated. There's a simplicity here that I'm grateful to God for beyond words. Whew. I mean, it's all by the grace of God, but by the grace of God, I can do this. Like, I mean, if this is the job description, by the grace of God, totally by the grace of God, but I can do this. So I actually find this liberating. And I find it liberating in a unique way or a particular way because I have so many close friends who have world-class gifting. And a few of them are sitting here on the front row. I mean, don't misunderstand. These are kind men and humble men, and I'm perplexed as to why they've given me the gift of friendship. If you ever see a picture of Mark, Al, Lig, and me, you should be thinking what I'm thinking. What's wrong with this picture? Who is the bald guy, and how did he get in this picture? You should, because I think that every time I see it. I have the deepest respect for these men, and I get to spend extended time with these men, and these men are just among the most gifted men on the planet. I mean, if there are more gifted men, I just haven't met those gifted men yet. And so somehow in the mystery of God's kind providence to me, they have given me the gift of their friendship, but that requires I spend time with them. And to spend time with them is to be made aware of how gifted they are, and it's also to be reminded how gifted I'm not. So the dynamic is taking place. They can talk about any subject. They can talk about every subject. They are like encyclopedic. It doesn't matter what the subject is. It doesn't matter how obscure it is. It doesn't matter whether it spontaneously emerges in the conversation. It doesn't matter if somebody just makes some side reference to something like the history of stained glass windows. It just doesn't matter. All three of them go at it. And by the way, when they're all together, there's a synergy between them. They're scary enough when you're with them individually, but they're all three together. And they're just quoting original sources, footnotes from original references. And they're just having this grand time together. And I'm there. I'm seated there. And here's what they do. They're very kind. They include me. They make eye contact with me. And they do. And they assume I know what they're talking about. Okay? So it's always an integrity issue when I'm with them, because after I'm with these guys, every time, Carolyn will tell you, this is part of the joke we have between us, she just asks me, well, how much of it did you understand this time? Because there's just percentages I give her that, you know, and a good time with them is like if I got 50%. I got 50%. That doesn't mean I'm perceiving in depth. It just means I've heard something about that somewhere. That's basically, that qualifies as part of the 50. Because most of the time, it's just a high percentage. I don't have a clue what you're talking about. So, when they make eye contact with me, I can't nod because I don't know what you're talking about. So, I spend an incredible amount of time just with my head fixed. Honestly, I need Advil when I'm done at times because I have to concentrate. I don't want to leave you the impression. No, my head. No, I'm not nodding. There's a reason I'm not nodding. I don't know what you're talking about. And often have to say, what does that word mean? Would you define that word? I have to interrupt. I mean, I do. I feel like I'm like 4 years older. What does that word mean? So whether it's preaching or leadership, it's just world class. And here's actually how I comfort myself in the midst of it. Normally, this is a thought that crosses my mind as I'm in the midst of listening to these world class leaders. Here's what I'm thinking. I am the best athlete in the room. By far. Okay. Oh, yeah. That's all I got. I just try to think of them as throwing a ball. You know, and then it's like really comforting. Although Lig can throw a ball. Lig needs to be distinguished from Mark and Al, who are not so athletic. Okay? But that's why they're so smart, rather than devoting themselves to athletics. They devoted themselves to reading everything that is available on the planet. It appears Lig did as well and played sports, so I'm not sure how to explain that. But so when I come to this passage, I think, oh man, okay, I can by the grace of God do this. I can preach the gospel by the grace of God. It's either Spurgeon or his grandfather. I can't ever find out exactly who said it, but it was either Spurgeon or his grandfather said, Whitfield and Wesley might preach the gospel better than I, but they cannot preach a better gospel. Now, I love it if it was Spurgeon, because the might works with him. They're just something Spurgeon's not going to fully concede. Spurgeon knows he's bringing some serious gifting to the pulpit as well, and that it's not unusual. Whitfield, Wesley, me. Yeah, humbly, true. So, these guys can all preach better than me. They can do Q&A. They're unbelievable in Q&A. But they don't have a better gospel. And by the grace of God, I can care for people. So this simplifies everything. So, Pastor, here's your biblical profile from Paul. This is the canonized version. That's something you're going to read in a book that's been assembled recently. And I pray you find this profile liberating. You don't have to have world-class gifts. You don't have to be culturally discerning. You don't have to be cool. You don't have to be laugh-out-loud funny. You have to have a heart for the gospel. You have to have a heart for people. Let's pray. Father, thank you for these men. Thank you even more for their wives. Lord, you know our hearts. We want to serve them. I believe their task is critical importance. Very difficult. We want to preach the gospel to them. We want to humble ourselves before them. We want to care for them. We want to make a difference in their lives. Thank you for this privilege. Pray that they will know fresh grace. Kevin's brilliant message this morning. My contribution. And now the rest of this day. Lord, you have smiled on this conference. This is a sweet time together. So we anticipate that sweetness continuing for the rest of the day. And we thank you, because it's all grace. In Jesus' name, amen.